Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Vavamud Bet, two lines from the bottom. Hanu Beitre, Davudaire. These two individuals who were living together, it seems like they were brothers who split up an estate or partners in a house. Echad Avadaire Eli, one of them had the upper house in the duplex. Echad Avadaire Tatai, and one of them had the lower house in the duplex. Itvar Tatai. The problem is that the lower house was sinking, or in essence, the ceiling was dropping. So now the lower house wants to rebuild because he wants to open up the space. He wants a higher ceiling. Upstairs, they're doing fine, so they have no vested interest in taking down the house or dealing with the issue. So the question is, at what point can the lower house compel the upper house to deal with the issue that's happening down below? So I'm related to Tali Lai, Ta Vinivne. Let us rebuild the house. Let's fix this due to construction. I'm doing fine. No reason for me to be involved in any construction. He says, I'll take it down and I'll rebuild it. He says, I have nowhere to live in the interim. So even though you're willing to undertake the construction costs, nevertheless, I have to leave the building while you do this and I have nowhere to live in the interim. Amarlei, ana uger lecha duchto. I'll rent you a place in the meantime. Amarlei, lo tarachna. Or lo kabayle tarach. Or the way lo matzinan di tarach. I'm not interested in all the undertakings. I have no interest in moving my stuff around. The aggravation of having to move. So he says, lo ka mitaderli. I can't live the way that I'm living right now. The ceiling keeps dropping on me. So what am I going to do? So he says back to him, Shufa krisech upok. So Rashi translates shof means che, means to bow down. Lower yourself and enter, lower yourself and go out. The way Tosfa reads it is shof is from the word shif shuf, which is to rub your belly on the ground. Yes, it says crawl in and crawl out. You deal with what it is. I don't have any obligation to deal with your problem. So he says, I'm not willing to, first of all, undertake the construction costs. Second of all, I'm not interested in leaving my house. And third of all, if I have an opportunity to go somewhere else, I don't want to have to do all the moving costs and the aggravation of moving. So I'm not going to agree to it. Amar Rav Chama Bedina Kam Akev. He has a right to do what he's doing here and to say that I'm not interested in the construction. Va'ani mile t'lo mate kishue d'mata me'asara. Says that's only true if the boards, the floorboards, but these are really the ceiling for him, hasn't dropped below 10 tefachim. Aval matuk shure d'mata me'asara, once they drop below 10 tefachim, matzi amarle, d'mata miyud r'shuta didehu. He says, once you go below 10 tefachim, the lower house can say, that's my area. A minimum height for a place to be considered livable or a space is 10 tefachim. Right, we have that minimum shiur by sukkah. We have that in other places with regards to dirah. 10 tefachim is the minimum standard. So if you hear, once the ceiling comes below 10 tefachim, then he's actually impinging on the lower person's space. Below mishabed lach. And you don't have a right or to come into my space. So now he has a right of rejection. Because beforehand, as the ceiling dropped, he had nothing to say. But once the ceiling gets below a certain space, then the upper person is living in the lower person's space already. So now he can tell him, listen, we got to rebuild. That's only the case where they did not have any agreement beforehand. If they preemptively, in their partnership agreement, had stated that if something happens to the lower apartment, that he would then cause them to rebuild, then they have to rebuild. Aval atnu gabe hadodi satre ubanu. If they have some sort of partnership agreement that says that once the lower party is inconvenienced that they will rebuild, then the upper party is compelled to comply with the partnership agreement. So now, if it's not spelled out as to how much the lower house has to lose before they rebuild, what is the standard or default number that you would use? So here we have where there is no partnership agreement, 10 tefachim is the standard because that's the lowest level that would be considered livable or habitable space. And therefore, when the upper space goes into there, they're actually impinging on the lower space. But now you put a partnership agreement which says that when the lower dirah has its ceiling drop, then we'll rebuild the whole thing. How much does it have to drop before it's considered to be an inconvenience? Obviously, if they spell it out, it's easy. But here they didn't spell it out. So now, but what standard governs this? So Amar Rabbanan kamei de Rabbo mishmei de Mar Zucha brei de Rav Nachman. The Amar mishmei de Rav Nachman ke ota shishaninu. Like we had learned otherwise. Over here we have Rabbo in our Girsa. You can see already the Masorah Shas changes it to Rava, which would make more sense. Again, because Rava is a Talmid of Rav Nachman, and so it makes sense that he's quoting something in the name of Rav Nachman from someone else who quoted in the name of Rav Nachman. So he says, this is something that we've seen before, which is Romo kechatzi arko uchatzi rachbo. So here they're trying to use some sort of paradigmatic standard of measurement, which is the Beit HaMikdash. In the Beit HaMikdash, when it comes to the Heichal, the Kodesh and the Kodesh HaKodeshim, we know that the size of the width and length of those areas, if you added them together, the length and the width, and then you cut it in half, that would be the height of the building that would be expected. And so since the Heichal itself was Orech, the length of the Heichal was 40 Amot, the width of the Heichal was 20 Amot, so together they add up to 60 Amot. If you cut them in half, that's 30, which is the height of the Heichal. They consider that as a paradigmatic building, where the height of the building measures to one half the sum of the width and the length of the building. So he says that that's the standard by which should govern over here. Take the length and the width of the house, and the height should be at 50% of that. And again here, it more likely is Rava, not Rabba. Haven't I told you already? Lotit le be buke srike. Don't put emptiness in the words of Rav Nachman. That's what Tosfot says over here. Srike, buke srike is anashim reikim. The targum of reikim is srikim, is empty. But here it means flasks full of air or hot air. I mean, it's just emptiness. You're saying things that have no basis. Heichal is not a standard for normal buildings. Heichal is the heichal. And we don't use that as a paradigm for determining what's going on in houses. Houses have utility that is specific to living in them, or they're being habitable, and therefore it has nothing to do with the Heichal. The truth is that you could have a house that is very wide and very long, and then you can all of a sudden say that you need a massive ceiling because of that. It doesn't make so much sense. It says, Lotit lube buki esrike b'Rav Nachman. Don't assign these silly memrot to Rav Nachman. Don't give attribution to something that makes no sense and say Rav Nachman said it. Hachi amai Rav Nachman. This is what Rav Nachman said. And again, that makes sense that Rava would be the one who's saying this because he's a Talmud of him. Kikadairi inche. It's the way that people normally live. It's just got to be normal. Vikama. What's normal? How do you determine what's normal? Am Ravuna Breda Rav Yeshua. Keichi de aile itzurita de mechuza. Behadar. It's a case where you can carry in a bundle of wood in mechuza, the standard, they had a standard size of a bundle of wood, and you can walk into the house with it on your back, and then turn around. Or walk in the house with it on your head, and turn around. Because that's considered to be normal utility. That's how what people did. They brought the wood into their house in order to utilize it. So you gotta be able to function like normal people function in these situations. That would give you the height, and you need clearance for the wood that is carried on your back or on your head. The door is the first thing, and the second thing is the ceiling, that you're able to turn around and then place it down. So that gives you a basic standard. I don't think this is an objective standard, I think it is a subjective standard, which is, in mechuza, that's what people did when they brought it into your house. So, in a standard house, you have to look at what is normal, whether there is some sort of governance, that there are standards that the state or the government puts in place, and that's a standard height that's there, or there's some sort of standard height that's used in houses. Whatever that is, that's what governs in these situations. Just could be the way that people normally live. And so over here, they use this as a guide, which is, this is what people need to do in their house. This is something that needed clearance. And so therefore, they use that as the measure. But if you go to other places and they needed clearance for whatever other reason, then that would become the standard. Whatever you need for clearance, that would be how high the house has to be before we demand that the upper party participate in rebuilding of the house. Now, the Gemara here is going to bring another case, and then between the two cases, the case that we just had in this case, they're going to come to some conclusions about what we're speaking about here. How gavra dava boni ashita achorei kave dechabre. He was building a wall adjacent to the windows of his friend. So Amalei kamafaleit alai. You are blocking my light. I have an easement for light, And since I have an easement for light, now when you put up the wall, you're blocking my ability to get the light into my house. Amalei, Sacharna Lecha. Sacharna means to plug up or to dam. Over here it means I will fill in the windows. Hacha, Vavina Lecha Kavei, Le'el Mish Ashitai. And then I will reopen your windows above my wall. So I'll seal in the windows now that are lower down so that they are not affected by the wall, and I'll reopen you windows upstairs. I mean, he's offering to pay for the construction costs to alleviate the problem. That's going to put wear and tear on my wall, and you're going to weaken the foundation of the wall by doing that. The work that it takes to put fill it in and then to open up new windows will leave the wall with less integrity. So he offers to him, Satana decha lashitach, aduchta dekavei, ubaninala. Says, alright, I will then pay for the taking down of the wall to the level of the windows, and then we will rebuild it from the level of the windows up. And when we rebuild it, we'll leave windows above the level. So now he can't complain about the integrity of the wall because filling in the windows, opening up the windows, which would shake the wall or the foundation of the wall. Over here, you're taking it all the way down to the level of the windows and rebuilding from scratch, not from the bottom, from the foundation, but building from the level which the windows were open. So that's the level you'll start, and then build the wall structurally sound from there up. Amalei, Ashita Mitata Atika says the lower foundation is an older wall. Umana'el Chadata. And the upper part is new. Lo Kaima. It, again, is not as structurally sound to put the newer wall over an older foundation because they don't necessarily mesh together. In their day, today is also true, there's a lot of settling after the house is put together. That settling, when you're dealing with walls that are made out of stones that can move and shift very heavily, even today with concrete, you see cracking and things that move with settling. Over here, with loose stones and large stones, the settling has a big impact on the wall. Once the wall has settled, it's much more secure and strong. Over here, what you're doing is you're taking out a wall that's already settled. You're leaving the foundation that's settled, but now you're putting a newer wall on top of it. So the new wall is not necessarily going to settle evenly because the lower part already settled. And now you're trying to have the upper wall settle on something that is much firmer than the whole wall moving together. And so he says, I don't want that. Says, fine, I'll take the entire wall down to the foundation, rebuild it from the ground up, and I'll put the windows in the place that they need to be. Says, now you have a problem. I'll have one new wall on the house, and the other three walls are older walls. So again, the settlement between the new wall and the older walls is going to be uneven. And that's going to cause a problem in the integrity of the house. Fine, I'll take the whole house down, rebuild it from the ground up, and I'll put the windows where they're supposed to be. Lately, says, I have nowhere to live in the interim. You're taking my house down, I have to live somewhere. I'll rent you a location. Lo, tarachna, or again, the change in the gear says, matzina di itarach. I don't want to be bothered with that. I don't want the aggravation, the frustration of moving all my stuff out and moving my stuff back in. Amar Rav Chama. Rav Chama says, "Bedin kama'akev." He has a right to do this. This is a fair claim and a fair rejection of the offer that is being made to him. So now here we had two cases, which the Gemara is going to say in 1 second, Hainu Hach. We just had two cases that basically said the exact same thing. So why do you need both cases? Now, as Tosafot points out, they're really not the same thing because the claims that he's making here about the building and about the wall and all of that are new information. The truth is that those are just pratim, details in the claim that he's making. The general claim is the same, which is that you can't compel me to do something if it inconveniences me or it leaves me in a worse position than I was before. I'm not obligated to make my life more difficult or make my situation less structurally sound in order to help you out or to make you have your wall where you need it. So that's why these are just details, but the bottom line is the same, which is I can reject your offers. Even though your offers are very generous, I can still in the end reject those offers. Now this sugya, without saying it, is really revolving around a concept called kufim al midat sedom. Kufim al midat sedom means that when we have an individual who can help out his friend without too much inconvenience, we will compel him to do it because Midat Sdom says, well, since I'm getting nothing out of it and you are benefiting, I'm going to stop it or I am going to block your ability to gain here, even though it presents no inconvenience to me. So there we have a concept called Kufima Midat Sdom. We will compel a person to help out his neighbor when there's no skin off his back when he helps out his neighbor. But if there is skin off his back, then you can't call it Kufim Amidat Sdom. So that's an important factor here, which is when Rav Chama says Bedin Kame'akev, that he has a right to say this, what we are saying now is that this is no longer Midat Sdom. His claim is valid. His not wanting to move out of his house and move back in again is a fair claim. It's a fair enough claim that he can say to the other guy, I don't want to do this, and I can reject your offer, even though I should be making out a lot better. I'm getting a whole brand new house that's built. Nevertheless, it's a fair thing to say, I don't want to move, and I don't want to move all my stuff around in the meantime. And so therefore, he can block the ability to build over here. And so therefore, Kofin Amidat Sdom means that in this situation, if you have no good reason as to why you are blocking your friend's building or making the changes here, we will compel you to acquiesce to those changes because of the fact that Kofin Amidat Sdom, you're not losing anything. Now, that might be even to take down the house. That might be even to do a full makeover, depending on what the circumstances are. If you don't have a sufficient reason for us not to do it, then we will compel you to do it because you're not losing anything over here. Although there are some Rishonim that say that there are limits to this and that people have protection on their houses, which by they, even if they have no reason, they can block the taking down of a house because it's considered to be such a basic building or structure that you can never demand of someone to allow them to take down a house and rebuild the house afterwards. Others suggest that if you have no good reason for it, that even that is open to Kofin Amidat Sdom. Gemara says, Hainu hach, that these are the same exact case. Vaha tu lomali. What do I need both cases for? Hakam achmalan, da'af agab dolo mishtamesh elativna ubeitzive be'alma. Even if the houses or the areas that we are speaking about are really storehouses, which involve tivna, teven, which is straw, ubeitzive is a wood house, they were just storage for his straw or for his wood, he is able to reject these overtures and say, I don't want to be inconvenienced by the move or changing or having to take the stuff out and put it back in. It's not just talking about a house. With a house, he might be able to say and reject it up front. By a house, he's saying, I want to move your windows from the lower area to the upper area. So he can say to him, I want the light down below by my floor and in the rooms where I am living or working. And therefore, I don't want my windows to go from where they are to the higher level. He might be able to reject it outright. At the first stage of this, he could have said no go. On the other hand, in a case where you're talking about a storage house, in a storage house, whether the window is low down or up top, it doesn't make such a big difference. And that's why you had this whole discussion about moving the windows, because over there, it's a reasonable request to ask him, look, I'll rebuild the windows at a higher location. It won't inconvenience you in your storage house. It's not such a big deal. There, we might argue that you are kufin al midat sedom because of that. The first case is talking about a beit dira, where you can say, I don't want to be inconvenienced in moving myself and my living space out. Over here, he's talking about not his living space, he's talking about a storage space. You can say about your storage space the same thing, which is, I don't want to be inconvenienced in moving my storage space to somewhere else and then having to replace the stuff and bring it back in. Now, how did the Gemara get there? One way to get there is to say the duplication by itself is what teaches you the Chiddush. We have to come up with something new, otherwise it's meaningless to say the same thing twice. So how do we do that? We say we're talking about storage instead of living space. On the other hand, there are those, based on what I just said, that say that it is inherent in the case. The fact that you're willing to move the windows from lower to higher means that you're not speaking about living space, but rather storage space. And that's what the Gemara is leaning on. The Gemara is leaning on the fact that he was willing to move the windows. That would only be true in storage spaces. That would not be true in a living space. And so that's what pushes the Gemara in that direction. So not the duplication, but rather the case itself is what moves it over there. Hanu beitre ache, the paleg bade hadodi. You have two brothers that split the estate between them. Chad machia ispelida, v'chad machia tarbitza. The way that they split it, one of them got the aspelida and one of them got the tarbitza. So as far as the Tarbitz is concerned, everybody translates that the same way. That is a garden. He took the garden that was outside of the Espelida. The question is, what's the Espelida? Rashi calls the Espelida a traklin. A traklin means like a palatial type of estate, a nice, really big house. That's what Rashi suggests that it is. The Balei Tosafot, they bring, first of all, from the Aruch, who says that it's a mi'ara, that it's a cave, because we find in other places that the word Espelida is used to mean a cave. The Balei Tosafot say that, based on the continuation of the Gemara, it doesn't seem to make any sense that we're talking about a cave here and not a house of some sort. And so therefore they reject the Aruch, but on the other hand, they don't accept Rashi's explanation, which is that it's a traklin, but rather they say that it's an achsadra. An achsadra is an area in towards the entrance of the house in which you have walls on three sides and the fourth wall is completely open. So it's a room, almost like an antechamber of entering, but it is an area that has a tremendous amount of light, because of the fact that the fourth wall is completely missing or completely open. So it's an area that's covered because it's roofed over. It's protected on three sides and open on one side. That's what he thinks it is. So here we have three possibilities. Traklin, an achsadra, or a me'ara as the possibility of what this esplida is. We'll see by the continuation of the Gemara as to why that's relevant. So now, Azal ha'u d'machia tarbitza, the one who had the garden as his portion, the Kabani Ashita Puma the Espelida. And he puts up a wall right in front of, well, whether it's a cave, a Nachsadra, or a Traklin. This is where Tosafot says that saying it's a cave doesn't make a lot of sense. So here he's putting up a wall to block the light. The light in a cave is very limited to start with, so it doesn't make so much sense. A cave is dark in the first place. To say that he put up a wall to block the light doesn't make a lot of sense. So that's why they favor either Traklin or Achsadra. So Achsadra would make a lot of sense because that's really built for its light. So here he puts up a wall right in front of it. Amalek, amafalat alai. You are darkening my space. Amalek, bididi, kabanina. Says I'm building in my own space. What are you making a claim for? What claim do you have? I'm doing it in my own space. What rights do you have over here? Now, as Rashi points out over here, when he says I'm building in my own space, that is not a fair claim. Just to say, because I'm building in my space and I'm hurting you, is not a fair claim. But that's true when you have an easement. When you have an easement there, that means, for instance, your neighbor's been there, and he's had these windows forever, and then you go put up a wall, you can't say, I'm putting up a wall on my own property, don't bother me. He'll say, I had rights or light rights here for a period of time. For you to now to come put up a wall, you don't have a right to block my light. But over here, they just split the properties. Since they just split the properties, there's no easement over here that he can claim light rights. And that's what Rashi says over here. He says, "B'shali ani bone v'ata in lecha leich chazkat urash shaloshanim dahashtehu debalginu." We just split this between us. So you have no easement rights over here or light rights over here. And that's why I can build it in my own and say, too bad. I'm doing what I am entitled to do. I'm Rav Chama b'din kamarle. Once again, Rav Chama says, this is a fair claim. He's making a fair and proper claim over here. Amarle Ravina Ravashi, Maishna Meha, Titanya. How is this different than a Braita that we are about to speak about, which is Shneachim Shilchuku, two brothers that split up an estate. Echad Matan Natal Stei Kerem, one of them took a vineyard. Echad Matan Natal Stei Lavan, and the other one took a grain field, a planting field. Yeshlo le balakerim dalet amot b'stei lavan. The balakerim has a right to move four amot into the stei lavan. Manat kein chilku, because that was the condition of the breakup, which is that a kerem always needs what's called avudata kerem. Avudata kerem is the four amot that allows him to move the wagons with the shvarim around the vines. So until this point, there was an ability to do that. Now that they divided it between the grain areas and the vineyard, so now if you cut the line right up against the vineyard, he's going to lack the ability to move his avodat kerem. So it's assumed that he has that right to do it because that's what a kerem has. It comes part and parcel with a kerem. So given that, it doesn't mean that he owns the land, the four amot. He has an easement to move his shvarim and his agala through that area because that's standard procedures for a kerem. So if here you have a split, and even though they split it, and there's no easement because they just split it, nevertheless, we said he's granted that right of easement to put his wagon and his shvarim in that area. So why isn't that the same as our case over here, where even though they split it, it would make sense that there's an easement here for the light. Amalei hatam da'alu ha'dodi. Over there, there was more than just a split. The split is uneven by nature because you have a vineyard and you have an area where you're planting grains. A vineyard is worth significantly more than the area with the planting of the grains. For that reason, you have to even out the split. How do you even out the split? Well, you put money in the package. That means that the person who got the vineyard was paying cash to the person who took the grain field in order to even out the split between them, in order to keep the values of equal nature. That means that there's money changing hands here as well. That means he almost, in a sense, purchased that right because of this split. That easement is coming because he paid for the kerem. And paying for the kerem, that comes with an easement. So what over here, what you're going to say? Dulo alul hadadi? He says, here they didn't pay money to each other. Here you also have an uneven split. One guy took this asplida, and the other guy took a garden. It's clear that the asplida is worth a lot more than the garden. V'chi b'shuftani askinen? Do you think we are dealing with fools over here? T'hai shakal asplida, v'hai shakal tarbitza, v'lo alula hadadi? And there's no evening out of the value. One guy took a garden, the other guy took the house, the afsadra, the mi'ara, whatever it is. And they're not evening out the cost over here. It's clear that there had to be some money that exchanged hands. If that's the case, then the person who took the house paid money to the person who took the garden, and with that he should have been able to buy the easement, similar to the case of the Braita. So Amalei, Nihi da'alu la'adadi demei, livnei kishure v'hudre. No, no, no. When they paid money, he was paying for the bricks, the boards, and the roof tiles. I mean that he was paying him for the materials. Demei avira lo'alu adadi. They weren't paying for air rights or light rights. That's not what was exchanged over here. So when you talk about paying for something by a kerem, it's integral to the kerem that you have avodat kerem. So when you exchange and pay for it, that's clearly what you're buying. When you buy a kerem, you expect to have avodat kerem. So when money changed hands, he definitely bought the easement. Over here, by a house, when he exchanged, the exchange in value is the value of the materials that make up the house. And then the garden. And that's what you are trying to even out in terms of the cost. So he says, V'leimile mi'ikara isplida palagli, hashta mishavetli idrona, or indrona. So he says, wait a minute, when we split it, I got an esplida. Now that you put up a wall, I no longer have an esplida, I have an indrona. You've changed the nature of that which I've taken. So what he is saying is that there is an intangible value that is here beyond the materials that build whatever is there. If you just talked about stones, wood, and roof tiles, they have a value. But when they're put together in a certain formation, then they have intangible value, which is I now have a house. But not only do I have a house that's called an esplida. And now when I split it with you, I paid you because of that esplida. That's how we assess the value that's here. When you put up the wall, you've now changed what it is that I have. So now, that's what forces Tosafot in favor of saying that this is an achsadra, is that the wall changes the dynamic here in terms of what it's called. Until now, it was called an esplida. After you put up the wall, it's called an indrona. An indrona is the equivalent of a hallway or a passageway. So now what you did was you took it from being an achsadra, which is an area with a ton of light and is useful, meaning because of the light that's there. And now you've just made it into a passageway, which means a dark antechamber or alley to get to the next place. It no longer has any utility by itself because of the lack of light. So that's why Tosfot translates it that way. Over here, the Rabbeinu Tam offers a completely different version or view of what this is. And he says that the split went in the following manner. They split a house and the garden. But the garden sat between the person who was in the house and the fields outside. So he's in the house and his fields are out surrounding the garden that's there. Now he has visibility to his fields from his house. He can look out his window and see his fields. The guy in the garden puts up a wall. He just cut his line of sight. It's not about light, but rather line of sight. And he cut his line of sight. Now he can't look at his fields. He can't see his fields anymore. And that's what he's complaining about. So that's what the Rabbeinu Tam explains that the problem is over here, which is, kamar mafalt ilavai. What does it mean that you're darkening it for me? It means that you are blocking my visibility over here, not that you are causing it to be dark. You don't give me the ability to see for long distances anymore. the Ri rejects that because he says then the comparison to the Kerem and the Ste Lavan don't make sense anymore. In that way we were explaining until now, you're splitting property and then there's easement rights on one side, then it makes sense, the comparison. If you're already talking about a line of sight is nothing like an easement for Avodat HaKerem. And therefore he says it's very hard to argue that these are comparable cases then, because a line of sight is not necessarily an easement of sorts. It's a convenience. He said, I took the house because I had the ability to see. Now you're taking away that ability. You can't argue necessarily that it's an easement. You can argue that it was a convenience that he took, and therefore he wants to keep that convenience. But then to bring in Avodat HaKerem versus the Ste Lavan doesn't necessarily make sense. For that reason, the Ri supports that what he said before, which is that here we're talking about putting up a wall that blocks the Echsadra, and the Echsadra is a building that is specifically there for its light. That's why it doesn't have a fourth wall, because it gives in or allows for a tremendous amount of light. Then when you put up a wall, you've basically taken away the utility or the name of this item. And then Amar Rav Shimi Barashi. Rav Shimi Barashi says, Shma Ba'alma Poligle. He says, who says that he gave him a esplida? Maybe he just gave him the name. Milo Tanya. Don't we have a Braita? And again, we just saw this at the end of Bava Metzia. Homer, Beit Kuf Afar Ani Mocher Lecha. He says, I'm selling you a Beit Kur, which is a standard measurement, which is an area of 75,000 square amot, but he noted that it was a Beit Kur Afar, which you would assume that means that it's 75,000 square amot of plantable space. Afabi Sheinu El Letach, even though in that 75,000 square amot, there's only a Letach. A Letach is half of a Kur. It's 15 Sa'ah versus a Kur, which is 30 Sa'ah. Even though half of the space is plantable, the other half is bedrock or not plantable space, he gets it. Because Vishalo Macharlo Elishma, he sold him what was called a Beit Kur. Vehu Dimitkari Beit Kur. As long as people call it a Beit Kur, then whatever he sold him, he gets. We'll in a second speak in the Balei HaTosafot and qualify that a little bit. But assuming that this is called a Beit Kur, the sale goes through because the name is what governs over here. Pardesani Mocher Lecha, I'm selling you an orchard. Afobi She'in Bo Rimonim. Even if it doesn't have pomegranates or fruit trees in it, higiyo shalom acharlo elishma. He was selling you this area that was called an orchard. Vehu demitzkari pardes. As long as it's still called an orchard, then that is fine. Kerem ani morchelach. I'm selling you a vineyard. Avo bishem bo gifanim. Even though there are no vines inside of this, higiyo. He bought it. Shalom acharlo elishma. He sold the name to him. Vehu demitzkari karma. That is assuming that it's called a kerem. So you have these examples. We bumped into this, again, at the end of Baba Metzia as well. That over here, the assumption is that, number one, the person knows what they're talking about, or the property that they're talking about, and he has to say the word zeh. Zeh means that this particular tract is what I'm selling you. If he's selling him a generic Beit Kur, then the person has a right to refuse it and say, I want a Beit Kur that is a standard Beit Kur that everyone would buy. Here he's saying Beit Kur Zeh. So he's specifying the property itself that he's selling him. Number two is the likely reason that these are called a Beit Kur or they're called a Pardes or a Kerem is because in the past they were utilized for that reason. So in the past it was a vineyard. And even though now there are no vines there, people still call it a vineyard because it was once a vineyard or an orchard because it once was an orchard. So the names stick despite the fact that there is no longer the original items in there that gave it its name. So Martha's Vineyard, even though these are now suburban areas or houses are built there, nevertheless, they retain the original names that gave them that name. So over here, if you sell in that manner, then the parties being aware of that know that what they're getting and that the sale is a good sale in Higiyo. Now Tosfot asks the obvious question, which is, look at the price that he paid. People pay a price that is commensurate to what they are receiving. So if they're paying for something that looks like a vineyard with vines in it, or an orchard with trees in it, then the money would dictate and tell you the price. If the price is less than that, meaning that he's paying him a discount, so then you know that he understands that he's buying something without the vines in it, without the trees in it. So Tosfot says it has to be that he's paying less. And that's what it's Vesh Lamar, the Mairi could go into Ozil Gabe. He charged him less than the standard price for a Beit Kur. He's not even paying him the amount of a letech, which is the plantable land there in this Beit Kur. He's not even paying him that much. So if they call it a Beit Kur, Even if there's only a letech worth of land in there, he gets it. V'ilo kari le beit kor. What's his recourse if the thing is not called a beit kor? Chayav latet lo beit kor shalem. Then he has to replace it and pay, give him a full beit kor. Inami, t'lo ozil gabe. He didn't charge him a cheaper rate. Kagon, the natan lo d'me letech. He paid him exactly the amount of plantable land that's there. That's what he paid for. Now, if they call it a beit kor, higio, that's good. It's a fine mekach. If not called a beit kor, then the buyer has a choice. He can say to him, "Im tirtze leteit li beit kor shalem, lamod b'mechamot. You want to give me a full beit kor? Then I'm fine. Give that to me, and I will stand by my part of the transaction. V'im lav tochzor li ma'udai. If not, give me my money back." So, in the case where it's not called a beit kor, Tosfot over here says that the buyer has recourse. And the recourse is that he can demand a full beit kor, or he can demand his money back. So that's the way that Tosfot frames it. If it is called a beit kor, then based on the money that he paid, as long as it matches somewhat to the value that he is receiving, then it's not considered to be a mekach ta'ot, and we assume that that is the transaction. He was aware of the fact that there was this beit kor. He was paying less because he knew or understood what he was buying. So as long as it qualifies in the name, then that works. And that's the important thing here is the Shema. So now, that's what Rav Shimi Ba'ashi is indicating over here. Why don't we say the same thing over in our case? Why don't we say Shema Macharle? He sold him something that's called an Esplida, even though it doesn't act like an Esplida anymore. So even though now by putting up the wall, he changed the dynamic of what's there, but it was called an Esplida before, it might be called an Esplida afterwards. Even though utility-wise, it's no longer functional like it was before, but he sold him something that was called an Esplida, and that's what he got. So the Gemara says, "Mi domi, how can you compare the cases?" Over there, by the case of the fields, he can say, or the pardes, or the orchards, or the vineyards, he can say, "I was selling you a name." So along the lines of what you're saying is that when we split it, I expected to utilize it the way that our father utilized it beforehand. I mean that I expected it to retain the utility or the structural rights and easements that it had before. I didn't take it to have it then be changed to the point where it's no longer the way our father lived in it. I took it because I expected it to remain the same way. So like you're saying, houses are a little different than when you're talking about fields. First of all, over here, they have a history together, which is that they inherited this from their father. And in inheriting it from their father, they have expectations as to how it is utilized. And maybe even a sense of an easement, which is that even though you're splitting the property now, nevertheless, there was an easement in the sense of how it was used beforehand. As opposed to the property where you have a mocher and lokeach who have no connection to each other, then when he's selling him, is he selling him the name that is associated with the property. But here, these are parties that have a relationship from beforehand. There, you might want to say that he bought from him exactly what the utility was prior to this point in time. So, Amrulei, Mar Yenoka, Umar Kishisha, Breder Abchista. So, the simple way to read this is, Mar Yenoka was the younger one. Mar Kishisha was the older child of Rav Chisda. Look in the Balei Tosafot, they say it's just the opposite. Mar Yenoka was the one born to him when Rav Chisda was young. Mar Kishisha was the child born to him when he was older. So it turns out to be just the opposite. That Mar Yenoka was the older brother, and Mar Kishisha was the younger brother. These two brothers, the children of Chisda, said to Rav Ashi, Nardai Litamayhu. The Nardai are following their own position. Nardai is the city of Shmuel. Shmuel was the Rosh Yeshiva there in the time that Rav was in Pumpadita. So you have Rav in Pumpadita and you have Shmuel in Nardai. Rav Chama, which the Gemara is going to indicate, and both Rashi and Tosafot indicate this, but the Gemara itself, it's implicit in the Gemara, is Rav Chama who gave the psak over here that he is Bedin Kama'akev. That he has a right to do this in all these cases. He says that Rav Chama, who says over here that he has a right to put up the wall and you can't stop him, is following the position of the Nardai. He is from Narda, and he's following the position of Nardai, which basically means he's following the position of Shmuel. That's what the Gemara says over here, the Amar of Nachman, Amar Shmuel. So now we're quoting it. Rav Nachman, the Talmud of Shmuel, is quoting Shmuel. These are the Nardai. Hachin Shechilku. There might be a different girsa here, which appears in other places in Shas, which is, Achim Shechilku Lukuchotein. that brothers that split are the equivalent of purchasers from each other. Even without that, it's implicit in the statement over here, in the memra from Shmuel, which is, Achim shel chuku, enem lo derech zelze, they don't have easement rights for access, velo chalonot zelze, they don't have window rights on each other, velo sulamot zelze, we'll go with Rashi's explanation right now, which is, they don't have ladder rights, which means that if you have the upper house and he has the lower house, you don't have a right to place your ladder or your stairs to get to your upper house in his chatzer to access it. And if they have two fields that are adjacent to each other, you don't have easement rights to bring the water channel through the other field to give your field. And be careful with them. They are steadfast halachot, and we don't budge from them. Rava Amar Yeshlehem. Rava is not bound by the Nardai. Right? He's in Mechuza. So he's not bound by that. He says that they do have these rights. So what is going on here that we are saying Shmuel litamayu or Nardai litamayu? That these are the Nardai according to their reasoning. The reasoning of the Nardai is based on Shmuel's position where he paskins like Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva has a machloket as to whether when a person sells something, which we'll see later on in the Masechta, does a seller sell b'ayin ra or b'ayin yafe? When a person sells something, do they sell in the most generous fashion possible? Or do they sell in the most miserly fashion possible? It's machloket tanaim. Rabbi Kiva is of the opinion that a mocher sells ba'ayin yafeh. He sells with the most generous manner. That means, for instance, if he sells an individual a captive something, that means when he sells it to him, he not only sells him the captive item, he's selling him access rights to there because he sells in a way that is generous. And vice versa. If he sells the surrounding property and he keeps the captive, he did not leave himself access rights. Because when he sold everything, and he didn't maintain rights until he specifies that I want the access to this point. So now when you talk about brothers that are splitting, brothers are purchasers, and they're sellers. In this case, each one of them is selling to the other one. So when they sell their rights to each other, they're selling the maximum amount, because you sell b'ayin yafeh. And the Ramban over here discusses what exactly the rights are that they sold to each other. It is the right that they sold to each other that they don't have to consider the other party at all. That's what it means that they were mocher b'ayin yafeh, which means that whatever I do, I can do, and I don't have to consider the implications on the other party. Or is it the other way around? Do we just say that you have to remove anything that causes damage to your friend? So as long as you're not causing damage, then we don't put any demands on you. But if you are causing damage, then we will put demands on you to block that damage or stop that damage, even if it comes at the expense of you having to close in a window. For instance, if you are looking over into his chatzer with your window, even though you have an easement for that, we will force you to block up the window because you're causing hezek ri'iyah. So either way, we are going to impinge on the easements that each party has. The question is, what is the dictating force over here? Is the force that I do what I want, I don't care what the other party does? Or does it say that if there's hezek, we can shut it down, even if it impinges on your easement? And that means that over here, in the case where two properties, and he needs access. So when he sold it to his brother, he gave him that property around or surrounds him. He didn't retain for himself access path. And that means, he does not have any easement rights here. Because when he sold it, he sold the surrounding property and did not leave himself access. Because he sold generously with an ayin yafeh. The same thing with the chalonot. When he sold it, he sold it without the window rights, without the light rights. So as Rashi explains over here, in the chalonot says that they don't have easement rights for light, and therefore the other person can put up a wall without any hesitation. Others suggest that it's in reverse, that if the window is causing a problem of hezek ri'iyah, the other party can demand that he shut in his window, and he loses his window, even though technically he should have an easement for the window. He has to block in his window because it's causing hezek ri'iyah. And that means when he sells it, he does not have those rights, or he does not retain those rights, which is speaking to our case. In our case here, where he gave him the garden, and he traded that for the house. When he took the house, he sold to the garden all rights, including the ability to block the light to the house, because he didn't retain for himself any rights. He sold in a generous or the most generous manner possible. Below sulamot zelzeh, the ladders. Rashi claims that it's talking about, again, staircase from the chatzer up into the upper chamber. The Balei HaTosafot over here say that that's the exact same thing as derech zelzeh. That's the same thing as access rights over there. And therefore, near the Ri, that it's talking about whether he has a right to put the ladder or the stairs against the wall of the lower house. The ability to use or lean the ladder or the staircase against the wall of that house. So that's what's being rejected over here, or saying that you don't have those rights. And Amat HaMayim, again, is two adjacent fields. The person with the field through whose property the water flows can just block it up and say, you don't have those rights anymore, you didn't buy those rights. Based on that, now we understand Rav Chama's psak. Rav Chama says, you can put up a wall and block his light. He has a right to do that. Because over here you have brothers who are splitting a property. They sold to each other. When they sold to each other, he did it in the most generous manner. That means that he didn't retain the easement rights for the light. Rav, on the other hand, does not subscribe to this position, the Narda, and therefore the claim of the individual to say, I bought an esplida, and now you've changed what I bought, or the fact that our father lived here in this manner, even if it's still called an esplida, I maintain those easement rights. And since I have those easement rights, you cannot put up this wall and block me. And that's Rav's position, as opposed to Rav Chama's position, which is following Shmuel's guide from Narda, because he's from the city of Narda. Right now the Gemara continues. Ho shtara diyatme. Dnafik alei tavra. There was this shtar of Yitomim, which had a tavra. Tavra is a shover. A shover is called a tavra, something that breaks it because it takes away from the efficacy of the document. When you have a receipt says that the document is no longer valid. So now you have this tavra that came out. Arav Chama, what are we going to do in this situation? Because you have tension here. We have the fact that you have the document of the Yitomim, but then we have a shover that seems to indicate that it was already paid and that they have no claim. So what do you do? Amechama, agvuye lo megvinenle. We do not collect on the shtar here because of the fact that we have a shover, which negates it. On the other hand, mikra lo karinenle. We don't rip up the shtar because of the fact that there is a possibility that the shover is problematic. And that's what Gemara says. You don't allow you to collect because there is a receipt. Mikralo karinenle, techigadle yatme, when the Yitomim grow up, dilma maiti raya umarile. Maybe when they grow up, they'll bring proof to the fact that this receipt is a forgery, or it's not real, and it doesn't apply to their shtar. So we leave it around for them to deal with the issue when they get older. Amale ravacha, braid rovo, the ravina, hilchotomai. Is the halacha like Rav Chama in this case? Amalei, bikulu hilchotu ki Rav Chama. In all these cases that we just mentioned in our daf, the halacha is like Rav Chama. In all of these cases, Rav Chama came out and spoke out and said, bedina kam akev. Those were the first two cases, that he has a right to stop the other party from doing what he's doing, even though the guy's made him an offer that he shouldn't be able to refuse. He doesn't want to leave his house. He doesn't want to move his stuff. He has a right. Rav Chama said that twice. Bedina kam akev, bedina kam akev. The third case of Rav Chama was the case where he said the guy with the garden has a right to put up a wall and block the light to the house. The fourth din of Rav Chama is over here. So what he says is, Bekulu hilchotak Rav Chama, lebar mitavra. Says the locha is like Rav Chama in all the three previous cases, with the exception of the shover here. This fourth case, the locha is not like Rav Chama. Desade b'shakre lo mechazakinan. We don't assume that witnesses lie. We assume that when there are witnesses on a document, that they didn't forge the document, that the document is a valid document, because we don't question the integrity of witnesses. We don't assume that they are lying witnesses. Assuming that the shover is strong enough, and therefore we would actually rip up the shtar based on that. Marzutra breder of Mariamar, Bahanami Hilchotuk Rav Chama. He disagrees and says, even in this case, the locha is like Rav Chama, which means a clean sweep. All four cases, the locha will be like Rav Chama. Dimita de Tavram al Yehu. If it was a good shover, if it was a good receipt, ibayle afuke bechaye avon. Why didn't it show up while the father was still alive? How come it only appeared after the father passed away? The fact that it only appeared after the father passed away already brings questions to the integrity of the receipt. Because if it was really a receipt, the receipt should have been around beforehand. All of a sudden it appears after the death of the father. Oh yeah, we found this receipt. Why did they only find the receipt now? That casts aspersions on the shover. The fact that it didn't show up until now implies that it is a forgery. Now, he still has to deal with the fact that we don't assume that the witnesses are lying. The answer to that problem is the witnesses didn't sign it. The witnesses' signatures were forged as well. So there, you can't make a claim that, oh, the witnesses, no, we don't question the witnesses' integrity. We only question the fact that whether the witnesses really did sign this or didn't sign this. Because it might be that they forged the signature of the witnesses. And based on that, Rav Chama's din is true, and therefore we will wait to see and will not rip up the shtar, but now also not pay the shtar and wait for other evidence to indicate to us whether the shuver is a good shuver or not. Next Mishnah. Kofim oto livnot beit shtar v'dalet l'chatzer. We compel him to build an entranceway and a door for the chatzer. The assumption being here that the chatzer, you have a number of houses in the chatzer, and they want to put something at the entranceway to make it secure and not allow people to enter or to look in. We quoted this earlier in the Gemara to show that there is hezek ri'iyah. The Gemara earlier said, hezek ed derabim shayni. When there's a huge public outside, then everybody agrees that there's hezek ri'iyah, because that's something where you're exposed to when too many people are to the public. And that's why you can compel an individual to build a door. If they all agree not to put up a door, that's fine. But if the parties there want to put up a door and one is refusing to contribute because he doesn't want a door, they can compel him to put up a door to secure the chatzer and to block the visibility into the chatzer from the rabbim that are outside. And in addition to that, they want to put up a beit shar. A beit shar is exactly what it sounds like. It's an entranceway. It's a gateway into the chatzer. The reason for doing that is that it gives shade to that area, and therefore they can have someone sit there and be a shomer in the shade. So it's the equivalent of the today where they have the budka outside the schools or outside areas where they guard, that the guard can sit in to protect himself from the weather, the elements, and guard the area. So the beit shar gives an awning of sorts to protect the area. They also can compel him to build that. Shimon Gamliel omer, lo kol ha-chatzerot ruyot the beit shar. Not all chatzerot are appropriate to have a beit shar. You have to look at the situation. Basically, what Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, it depends where the chatzer opens to. If the chatzer is very close to the Rishut Rabim, or opens directly into the Rishut Rabim, it makes sense to have a beit shar. But if the chatzer is deep inside of a mavoi, which means that the Rishut Rabim comes into the mavoi, and then the mavoi, you have deep in the mavoi, you have an entrance to a chatzer, why do you need a beit shar over there? Why do you need a guardhouse over there? Why do you need this extra building over there? You're in an area that's much more secure, and you're in an area where people don't come very frequently. So then it's not reasonable to assume that you need a beit shar. The Chachamim disagree with him and say, sometimes, that even when you're deep in the Mavoi, and the overflow of people sometimes reaches deep into the Mavoi. Or when the people earlier, the Chatzerot that earlier have a lot of people there, sometimes their extra people file down to deeper in the Mavoi. And therefore, all Chatzerot could use that Beit Shar. So that's the Machloket that we have here. Then the Gemara says, Kofinoto, livnot, le'ir choma, v'daltayim uvriach. We compel residents of the city to put up a wall and doors or gates to the city, ubriach, and a lock to the city, basically to secure the city. So you can compel the parties or residents that live in the city to build a wall around the city and put up gates and locks so that this is a secure area. Shimon Gamliel omer, lo kol ha'ireot ruyot lechoma. Not all cities are appropriate for a wall, a lock, and a gate. The way that he is expressing it is that it depends where the city is located. If it's located on the safar, if it's located on the border, then it makes sense that you need a secure city because you're up against the enemy, you're exposed to areas where it could be invaded or it could be attacked. Cities that are further in, they're not the ones that are going to be attacked. They don't need to have walls around them. The Chachamim say that's not always true. Sometimes they get through the first defense lines, and you need a defense in the second line, or sometimes they walk around the first ones. They don't attack them. They go straight to the inner cities. So because of that, every city is ra'oi l'choma. Kamiyehei be'ir, ve'kanshe'ir. How much time does he have to be a resident of the city to be considered a resident for taxation? Yudvet chodesh. You have to live there for 12 months. So you become a resident of the city if you're there for 12 months. If you're there less than 12 months, you're considered to be a temporary resident, and therefore you don't have to contribute to the basic infrastructure of the city. Kanaba beit dira, if you buy a house there, then you become a resident of the city immediately. So if you are a renter, you have to be there for more than 12 months to be considered a resident of the city or to have to pay taxes. If you are a landlord, meaning you own a place in the city, then you become an owner and a resident immediately, because the purchase of the house makes you a part and parcel of the city or the residents of the city who will benefit from all the infrastructure that is put in for the city. The person who's renting is not necessarily a beneficiary because he's there for the short term. So the infrastructure is a much longer term type of situation. And therefore, when you're talking about taxation, you only tax people who are going to be there so that they will gain the benefit of that long-term infrastructure. Mara says, Lememra de Beit Shar Malyutahi. From our Mishnah, it seems very clear that a Beit Shar is something positive. It's something that we would compel other people to do because it's to the benefit of the residents of the Chatzer. Va'u Chasido. We have an incident with this Chasid, this righteous individual. Davar Rogil Eliyahu Davar Mishtayiva Adei. Eliyahu used to come and learn with him or visit him on a regular basis. Avad Beit Shar. He built a Beit Shar for his Chatzer. V'tulo Mishtayiva Adei. Eliyahu stopped coming to visit him. Lo kasha, that's not a problem. Ha mi gavai, ha mi barai, or mi avrai. Here, that's on the inside, that is on the outside. We'll go with Rashi's interpretation. Just know that many of the Rishonim, especially Rishonim Sefarad, disagree with Rashi, but the Rishonim Ashkenaz, Rashi, Tosafot, and others, go with the explanation of Rashi. So Rashi explains over here, the Beit Sha'ar is made up of, in essence, two doors to it. It's almost like when you have an entrance to your house, where you have an additional door you come in, and then you have either like a porch area or a mudroom, and then you have a second door which actually enters into the house. So depending on how you've structured it, where is the Beit Shar? The Beit Shar can sit outside of the wall, or the Beit Shar can sit inside of the wall. It's clear that the door will be at the level at the Chatzer's wall. That's where you want to secure. You're trying to secure the Chatzer, and that's where the door is. So now, if you put the Beit Shar inside of the Chatzer, that means that there's a door at the wall of the Chatzer. And then inside, again, there's this entranceway and then another door to get into the Chatzer. And in between those two doors is where the Shomer would sit. But that means that if a poor person comes to the Beit Shar and he's trying to get the attention of the residents, he can't call in anymore. Because when he's now outside the wall of the Chatzer, outside the outer door of the Beit Shar. So when he calls in, his voice is blocked by the Beit Shar itself, because he has to go through that door, the next door of the Beit Shar, and then only then do you have the residents of the Chatzer. They're not going to hear him because his voice is going to be dulled by the fact that you have two doorways before they get to the Chatzer. If you make it me'evrai, if you put the Beit Shar on the outside, that means that the secure door is the inner door of the Beit Shar. The outer door is just there to protect or to leave it so that people don't enter on a regular basis, but you can enter. Now, the question is even a door on the outside then, because we'll see in a second, the Gemara is going to move through that. So then, when you enter into the Beit Shar, the Ani can still get to the area that is adjacent to the Chatzer. He'll walk into the Beit Shar, and then the second doorway at the other end of the Beit Shar, which is the level of the Chatzer, he'll get there, and then he'll scream, and those residents will hear him like you heard before. And that's the answer here. That if you put up a Beit Shar that is inside, that is a negative. That's why Eliyahu stopped coming to this Chassid, because he basically cut off the ability of the Aniyim to call out to him and ask for help. On the other hand, when we say that it's a positive, is when you put the Beit Shar outside the wall, because then you don't change that dynamic of the Aniyim of being able to call out to the residents of the Chatzer. So now, here, the Gemara says, you could say both cases are cases where the Beit Shar is found outside the wall of the Chatzer. So in Tosfot over here said there was an alternative, and he rejects that explanation because he says it doesn't make any sense. Because once you are migavai, once you are inside, the outer door is flush with the wall of the Chatzer, and that door is always closed or locked. Nobody's going to let you go into the entrance way when it's already inside the Chatzer. So Tosfot says that's the end of the discussion with regards to it if you go givai. Me'avrai, then there's something to discuss over here, as we'll see that there are other alternatives as to the Avrai, whether it is facilitating the ability of the Ani to get there or not. Now, obviously, Tosfot is influenced by the explanation that we've been given until now, that the Gavai is the negative and the Avrai is the positive. Again, for those that explain the opposite of what we said, that the Gavai gives you the ability to call out to the residents because you can now get into the Beit Shar when you call out, you're already inside the Chatzer, versus the Me'avrai, which doesn't give you ability to communicate with the residents because you're forced to stay outside the Chatzer. So that's the view, then Ibayitema, haha mi gavai would make sense in that case. But alright, that's a separate way to read the Gemara. We're going to read according to the Balei Tosfot and Rashi that Evrai is the better situation. Velo kasha, adi le delet. Depends if it has the doors on it or not. If you have the Beit Shar outside the Chatzer, the inner door is closed for sure because that's flush with the wall of the Chatzer. The outer area, is it just an open porch or awning, so that when you walk into that area, you're walking into something that's completely open, and you can still get access to the door that is adjacent to the chaser. Or is there a second set of doors at the awning or the front of the porch? That means that you can't gain access even into the porch area to get to the door that is adjacent to the chaser. So that would be the case. The case where Eliyahu stopped coming is the case where we had two sets of doors. He had a door at the back of the Beit Shear, which was flush with the wall of the chaser, and he had doors at the front of the porch, which didn't let him even get access to that area to be adjacent to the chaser. In the case where we're talking about in our Mishnah, is where the awning or the porch is open. So you can walk into the porch and still reach the door that is adjacent to the chaser, and that would make a difference. Or, Ibai Dema, Havahadi Ledelet. No, the case is here is where the Beit Shear has two sets of doors, the inner doors and the outer doors. Depends if it has a lock on it or not. If the outer door doesn't have a lock on it, then the ani can enter, anybody can enter the outer doors because they're not locked. The inner doors are locked, but the outer doors are not locked, so you can always gain access. If the outer door is locked, then he can't get access to the inner doors to call out to the people of the chaser. Both cases are cases where they have a lock on it. Here's a case where the lock is on the outside or the inside. Now, a putachat is really a key to open up the lock. But in essence, the key to open up the lock is a door handle. So it's the equivalent of having a door that has a handle on the inside or a door that has a handle on the outside. If the door has a handle on the outside, then the people on the outside can access the house because it has a handle, a putachat, that allows them to open up the door. If the key or the handle is on the inside, then only people on the inside can open up the door. The people on the outside can't open up the door. So if the outer doors, you have two sets of doors, you have inner doors and outer doors. The access to the outer doors, how is that facilitated? If it's a handle that's on the inside, that means that anybody on the outside can't access, and they're blocked by two sets of doors. On the other hand, if the handle is on the outside, then the people outside could open it up and enter in, meaning you have access. Why put a door with a handle there that anybody can access? First of all, it stops animals from getting in there. They can't walk through a door that has a handle on it. Number two is that people don't just accidentally or just come in there to block themselves from the rain. They have to actively go in there, so they have to turn a handle. So that's another reason to have it. In addition, just for protection from the elements, you'd want to have the door closed and be secure so that it just doesn't open. So the putachat facilitates that. Usually when they had something like that, there was also a hole in the door. That meant that if the handle was on the outside, there was a hole in the door, and you could reach your hand out from the inside to open the door from the outside when the handle was on the outside. That way, people on the inside and the outside could get in. People inside weren't locked in, because they could reach and open up the handle. So for that reason, the case where the handle's on the outside, that's okay, that's good, because then the aniim can still access the Beit Shear and then get to the door by the chaser. And then if the potachat, if the handle or the lock is on the inside, then only the people on the inside could open it up. That means the people outside have no access. They're still stuck behind two sets of doors. And therefore, here the Gemara gives you different options as to when it's considered to be positive to put up a Beit Shear, when it's considered to be negative when you put up a Beit Shear. The only thing Tosafot notes is that if you say, Ibai Dema, Habahab Mi'avrai, in the first case, it does not follow the pattern of the Ibai Demas. In the Ibai Demas, in each case, it took the worst of the two scenarios, and said, even when you have the worst of two scenarios, I can still explain it that it's okay. In the first case, Avrai and Gavai, Gavai was the worst of the two scenarios, and Avrai was the better. So in the first case, it says, oh, the difference is between a Beit Shear inside and a Beit Shear outside. Over there, we said the inside is problematic, the outside is good. Then it goes, Ibai Dema, okay, both of them are on the outside, and the question you have is a door, it doesn't have a door. Then it moves from there and says, oh, even if it has a door, we can still make it good and bad. And even if it has a lock, we can still make it good or bad. So there's a difference in the sequence between the first case where we took the Avrai, which was the positive case, and then expanded on it, versus all the other cases where we took the negative and said, even if it's negative, we can still make it into something that is good. So Tosafot just points out that inconsistency, given the girsa that he has, that it's Ibai Dema Habaha Me'avrai. Right now, we continue. Kovino told if not Beit Shear, Vedela the Chatzer. Tanya, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Lo Kol HaChatzerot Ruyot the Beit Shear, Ela Chatzer Smukha the Rishut HaRabim. Something that's close to the public thoroughfare, Ruya the Beit Shear. Shein Smukha the Rishut HaRabim, in Ruya the Beit Shear. Now it seems that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel agrees that a Delet, a door, everybody agrees that you have to put up. He's only arguing about whether you need a Beit Shar versus a Delet. A Delet seems to be a basic thing that you would put up and you can compel him. Question is, can you compel him to build a Beit Shar in that area? Rav Shimon Gamliel says it depends on the location of the Yichatzer. Rabbanan zimni de dachgei b'nei rishut rabbeim v'aylu v'atu. As we mentioned before, sometimes the Rabim gets pushed into the Mavoi, or there's too much activity by the Chatzerot that are earlier in the Mavoi, and therefore there's more and more people down further down the Mavoi. So even in those cases, people that are further away from the Shut Rabim are still affected by the fact that Rabim can gain access to there, even though it's less likely. And therefore the Chachamim believe you can compel a Beit Shar. Kofino to livnot le'ir. Over here again, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, lo kol ayreot ruyot l'chuma. Not every city requires a wall. Ela ira smucha l'safar. Only cities that are close to the border, ruya l'choma. Sheinu smucha l'safar, in ruya l'choma. Those that are not near the border don't require walls. Rabbanan zimni de mikre v'atu gaisa. Sometimes the troops skip those cities and they get to the inner cities, or they already penetrated the outer cities and they're going to reach the inner city. So every city is ruoy for a wall. By mine Rabbi Lazar mi Rabbi Yochanan. So Rabbi Lazar, Talmid Rabbi Yochanan says to him, k'shein govin, lefi nefashot govim, odim lefi shevach mamon govim. When they collect money for the shared expense of the city, how do we assess the tax on the individuals? Do we assess it by the number of parties that are there? It's a per capita tax? Or do we assess it based on the monetary means, the economic means of the individuals? The question is this a flat tax, which is that everybody is paying the same amount of tax? Or is this basically a tax that is a percentage, in essence, of your net worth or a percentage of your earnings by which every person's earnings will affect the amount they have to contribute? Some of the Rishonim point out, based on the rest of the Gemara here, that the question is more fundamental than that. The question revolves around why you need the wall. Is the wall an economic benefit, or is the wall a protection for the lives of the individuals? When it comes to sakanat nefashot, when it comes to danger, everybody's equal. There's no difference between whether you're rich or poor. Everybody needs the same protection in terms of life. In terms of monetary exposure, meaning that you need to protect your possessions, then it would make sense that people with more possessions or more wealth require the protection more than the people that have less wealth or less money. And for that reason, you would then tax based on your net worth or your material possessions, rather than number of parties that are in this city. Samarlei, the fi mamon govim. He says it's a monetary decision, and therefore it's based on your ability to afford the tax. You will pay more if you are wealthier, you'll pay less if you are poorer. Ve'elazar b'ni, he's speaking to his Talmud, he says, Elazar, my son, kava ba mesmerot. Similar to what we saw before, put nails in it, meaning this is a fixed halacha. Don't deviate from this halacha. It's all based on your economic ability to pay for it. When they collect for this tax for building the wall, the fee kiruv batim hein govin? Is it based on who's closer to the wall? For the fee shevach mamon govim. Or we do it based on the wealth of the individuals. Now over here, the fee kiruv batim, and this is true if you read accounts of cities that are attacked, that as the people retreat within the cities, they move deeper and deeper into the cities as the walls are penetrated. It happened in Yerushalayim. When the walls were breached in Yerushalayim, the people keep retreating further and further and deeper into the city. Because by nature, the way the houses were built in those times, they created defenses or walls. And it was true in the Warsaw Ghetto as well. So once they broke through the outer walls, the people retreat further and deeper into the city. So that means that the people more towards the center of the city are by design or by nature protected more than the people that are out towards the walls. So the people towards the walls need more protection or are in need of the wall more than the people towards the center of the city. It doesn't mean that they both don't need it. It's just a question of who needs it more. So over here, Rabbi Yochanan answers and says, Amalei lefi kiruv batim en govin. Has to do with your proximity to the wall, how much you have to pay. Belazar b'ni kavaba masmerot. Put nails in that. Again, this is a halacha kvua. The Rabbeinu Tam over here suggests that the two piskei halacha of Rabbi Yochanan here are not mutually exclusive. They are actually jointly true. Which is in the first case, Rabbi Yochanan says that it has to do with your ability to pay, your economic situation is the way that we tax you. In the second case, Rabbi Yochanan says it has to do with your proximity to the wall. And what the Rabbeinu Tam points out in the Balei Tosafot and other Rishonim that agree with this is that you do both. That means that someone who is poor, who lives closer to the wall, will pay more than someone who is poor, who lives further away from the wall. Someone that is wealthy, who lives closer to the wall, will pay more than a wealthy person that is further away from the wall. But an ani close to the wall and an ashir further away, the ashir will still end up paying more than the ani that is closer to the wall. So we take the economic capability to pay into consideration, but we also overlay on that how close or how proximate you are to the wall. So there is a grading of payment based on how close you are to the wall, but that is determined by your economic ability to pay. And so people of similar economic standing, the one closer to the wall will pay more, the one further away will pay less. But that doesn't mean a poor person near the wall is going to pay more than a rich person in the center of the city. Although the Rama does have an interesting nuance or twist on this, which is that the more that a person is towards the center of the city, the less wall he needs. As the city expands and moves outward, the larger the wall needs to be to encompass the perimeter of the houses that are there. And therefore, someone towards the center of the city on a percentage basis has to contribute less than the people that are living towards the outer parts or the outer limits of the city, because the further out you are, the more wall you are causing them to build in order to get the circumference around the city. So that's an interesting view, but that's why he explains that there should be a difference as to whether you live towards the center of the city or towards the outer part of the city. Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya. So Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya was a grandson of Yehuda Nasi. He's at the borderline between the Tanaim and Amoraim. He also had a grandson named Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya. So it's not clear here if we're talking about the first Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya or the second Rabbi Yehuda Nisiya. Although from the context, it seems like it's the second one. Rama Deshura Arabonon. He taxed the Rabbonon for the paying of the wall, or to build the wall, or to do renovations on the wall, or upkeep on the wall of the city. He taxed the Rabbonon like any other of the residents of the city. Amar Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish rejects this taxation and says, Rabbonon lo tzricha nitiruta. The Rabbonon do not require protection. Dichtiv, because the pasuk says in Tehillim, Espireim michol yirun. I will enumerate them, and they'll be more numerous than the grains of sand. Espireim leman. Who is Hashem enumerating or counting over here? Ilei melet tzadikim. If you're talking about the righteous, dinefishay mechalo, that they are more numerous than the grains of sand on the beach. Hashto kuli srokti babu. All of Bnei Yisrael, it says, Kechol Asher Sfatayam, that they're going to be like the sand on the edge of the ocean. Tzadikim Atzman Mechol Yirbeun. Then how could Tzadikim exceed the number of Bnei Yisrael? If Bnei Yisrael compared to Kechol Hayam, how can you say now that Tzadikim are in excess of Chol Hayam? It doesn't make any sense. Elohi Kamar, this is what's meant by the Pasuk. Espereim Lemaseihem Shel Tzadikim. I will enumerate, I will count the good deeds of the tzaddikim, the actions that they take, michol yibun, they will be more numerous than the grains of sand on the beach. Bekavachomer, and now it is a kavachomer. Machol shimuat magin alayam, sand which is a limited resource on the beach, yet it stops the ocean from coming onto land, onto dry land. Maseim shel tzaddikim shemirubim, the righteous acts of the tzaddikim would exceed the cholayam. Certainly they should protect them, and therefore they're not in need of the physical protection of the wall because they have the spiritual protection, meaning they have God, their protector, because of their masim tovim. And therefore they don't need to contribute to the wall because they are afforded protection from their actions, from their righteousness. And so Reish Lakish says that they should not have taxed the Rabbanan to pay for the wall because it's not necessary. Now the truth is that the limud of Reish Lakish comes out from the pasuk because of the context of the pasuk. The previous pasuk says, "V'leib mayakru reecha kel me'atzmu roshehem." How weighty or how great are your thoughts, seem to me, God? How great are their numbers, or they are innumerable? Espereim michol yirbeun hakitzoti v'odi imach. I count them, and they exceed the grains of sand But in the end, I woke up, and I'm still with you in the end, Hashem. Over here, as the Baal Tosafot point out, that the Re'acha, instead of calling it thoughts in the previous Pasuk, they call Re'acha the Tzadikim. Therefore, they're taking Re'acha much more literally, which is Li Mayakru Re'acha Kel. How precious are your Tzadikim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Me'atzmu Roshehem. How great are their number? And then continuing to our Pasuk is Esperei Michol Yerbeun. I count them and they exceed the grains of sand. To which the Gemara, Reish Lakish, points out that doesn't make sense because if Bnei Yisrael are only Kechol HaSfat HaYam, how can they be greater in number than the grains of sand on the shoreline? So the answer is that it's not talking about the Tzadikim themselves, or rather Masehem, their actions, their good deeds. And that's what is being enumerated over here, and that's what Hashem says, that they are greater than Kechol Yerbeun. Then the Gemara draws the parallel between that and the fact that the sand on the shoreline stops the water or the waves from coming inland. If the sand can do that, so too the Masim of the Tzadikim can protect them. And that's the drasha of Reish Lakish. Ki'ata kameda Rabbi Yochanan. When he came before Rabbi Yochanan, Malay, my taima lo temilei meha. Why did you bring your proof from there? You should have brought your proof from here, from Shir HaShirim, which is ani chuma v'shadai kemigdalot. I am like a wall, and my bosoms are like towers. Ani chuma zo Torah. That references to the Torah. V'shadai kemigdalot elu tamidei chachamim. So you see that the tamidei chachamim are considered like the towers. The towers of the wall are the protection of the city. So they have protection from being Tamidei Chachamim. They don't require the physical wall. Reish Lakish Savrala Kedorish Rava. Reish Lakish held of the other drasha with regards to this, which is Ani Choma Zo Knesset Yisrael. That refers to Klal Yisrael. V'shadai Kemigdalot Elu Batei Knesiot Ubatei Midrashot. And that refers to the houses of learning and the houses of prayer, not to the Tamidei Chachamim directly. And therefore, Reish Lakish didn't bring his proof from there, but rather from the Pasuk in Te'ilim. But the underlying theme, and we're going to see this continuing tomorrow's Gemara, is that the Rabbanan should be exempt from the tax because physical protection is not necessary for them. This is a continuation of what we saw in the Gemara in Baba Metzia about when Chachamim have to contribute to infrastructure. And over there, the Gemara told us in Baba Metzia that they are patur from paying for the wall, but they're chayav to pay for the water source, or to make sure there's mayan, or there's water there. Because they necessitate the water, the wall is not necessary for them, based on the Gemara here, which suggests that they are protected without a physical wall. So since they don't need the infrastructure of the wall, they don't have to pay for it. Water, which they do need, they have to pay for that infrastructure. Elohim Cain, we saw there that if they did it, the people of the city did it themselves, and it's beneath the dignity of the Talmid Chacham to join in and dig and to make the water channels that are necessary, then the Chachamim don't have to participate. But monetarily, they would be obligated to participate. And we'll continue with this Gemara tomorrow to discuss more in detail the exemptions of the Chachamim from certain taxations based on their status. Okay, we're going to stop here on the third line of Chet Amud Aleph.